cover. If intelligence, like height, turns out to be omnigenic, the 52 genes will be only the start of a long list that will keep growing for years. Perhaps there will be a core of genes that shapes the brain in ways that influence intelligence test scores. But the search will take scientists out to rings after rings of more distant networks of genes. And even if scientists gain all this knowledge, they will still be a long way from a complete understanding of intelligence itself. To Galton, Pearson, and their fellow hardcore hereditarians, intelligence seemed a case in which nature trounced nurture. Henry Goddard even convinced himself that all feeble-mindedness could be explained by a single Mendelian mutation. In the extreme form of this view, intelligence was like blood types. Your blood type has nothing to do with whether your parents told you to turn off the television, or whether you ate 3 decent meals a day, or if you got chickenpox in grade school. Your type was fixed as soon as your parents' genes came together to form a new genome. Intelligence is far from blood types. While test scores are unquestionably heritable, their hereditability is not 100%. It sits instead somewhere near the middle of the range of possibilities. While identical twins often end up with similar test scores, sometimes they don't. If you get average scores on intelligence tests, it's entirely possible your children may turn out to be geniuses. And if you're a genius, you should be smart enough to recognize your children may not follow suit. Intelligence is not a thing to will to your descendants like a crown. As hard as it has been for scientists to tease out the genes involved in intelligence, mapping the influence of the environment is even harder. It requires venturing into a daunting wilderness that lies outside the mathematical tranquility of genome-wide association studies. Psychologists who want to figure out the environment's contribution to intelligence have to take into account kindness and trauma, the biochemistry of the womb, and the impact of stress on the brain. The influences of the environment cannot be snapped apart into distinct chunks the way genetic variants can. They ramify each other, forming a mycelium of experience. One reason for this complexity is that intelligence, like height, develops. In an embryo, it does not yet exist. Children need a few years of growth and experience before they can get a meaningful predictive score on an intelligence test. All along that path, experiences can influence how intelligence develops, and different experiences can lead to different intelligence test scores. While the environment can probably influence intelligence in many subtle ways, scientists understand a few strong effects best. If a mother drinks heavily during pregnancy, the alcohol can interfere with the growth of neurons, leading to fetal alcohol syndrome. After birth, a child's brain continues growing swiftly, and along the way it stays vulnerable to toxins such as lead paint. Sometimes the enemies of intelligence work together to wreak havoc. In 1999, Brenda Eskenazi and her colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, went to the farming communities of the Salinas Valley to see how intelligence is influenced by the pesticides sprayed on the fields. They followed 601 women through their pregnancies and then tracked the development of their children. The children of mothers with the highest levels of pesticide in their blood scored low on intelligence tests they took at age 7. And Eskenazi also found that poverty, abuse, and other kinds of adversity worsened the effects of the pesticides. The environment's power isn't limited to lowering intelligence test scores, however. It can, under certain circumstances, lift them up. One of the simplest ways to do so, it turns out, is to give people iodine. Iodine is essential for making hormones in the thyroid gland. A lack of iodine can lead to a number of diseases, including a neck swelling called goiter. It can also lead to cretinism, which leads to both dwarfism and severe intellectual disability. Normally, a pregnant mother's thyroid hormones travel into the brain of her fetus, where they help neurons crawl to their proper location in the brain. If she has a deficiency of iodine, she makes fewer hormones, leaving the fetal brain to fail to develop properly. To keep our iodine levels high, we depend on our food. Seafood is a good source of iodine because the element is abundant at sea. Meat and vegetables and milk can be good sources too, but only if they come from places where the soil is rich in iodine. A third of the world's population lives in places that put them at risk of iodine deficiency. Adding it to salt is all that's necessary to give people healthy levels of iodine. When the United States and other countries established this policy in the early 1900s, both goiter and cretinism started to disappear. Another century would pass before scientists began uncovering evidence that iodine deficiency may have a much wider impact on intelligence. Sarah Bath of the University of Surrey and her colleagues documented this effect in a survey of children growing up in southwestern England. England has never required iodine be added to salt, in the belief that people could get enough of it in milk. That turns out to have been wrong. Bath and her colleagues found that 2/3 of the pregnant women they studied had a mild iodine deficiency. And the children of these women, Bath found, got significantly lower verbal IQ scores at age 8 and scored lower at age 9 on tests for reading accuracy and comprehension. The growing appreciation for iodine's importance for intelligence led James Farrer, an economist at Dartmouth College, to take a fresh look at its history. He took advantage of the fact that the introduction of iodine in the United States fell squarely between the two world wars. Millions of young American men who served in World War I lacked the benefit of iodized salt. Thanks to their iodine deficiency, 12,000 recruits had goiter, a third of whom couldn't button a military tunic around their neck and were judged unfit for service. But by the time the military inspected recruits for World War II, the rate of goiters had dropped 60%. Farrer wondered if this shift also affected the intelligence of the recruits. He was not allowed to look at their individual IQ scores, but he and his colleagues found a way to infer them. The highest-scoring recruits were put into the Air Force instead of the ground forces. Reviewing the records of 2 million recruits, Farrer and his colleagues also checked the natural iodine levels in their hometowns. Nationwide, the researchers found, the introduction of iodine raised the average IQ by an estimated 3.5 points. And in the parts of the country where natural iodine levels were lowest, Farrer and his colleagues estimated the scores leaped 15 points. It may be hard to believe that such a straightforward change in people's diets could have such a tremendous effect on intelligence. But as public health workers continue to bring iodine to more of the world, the same jumps happen. In 1990, Robert DeLong, an expert on iodine at Duke University, traveled to the Taklamakan Desert in western China. The region has extremely low levels of iodine in the soil, and the people in the region have resisted attempts to introduce iodized salt. It didn't help that the people of the region, the Uyghurs, distrusted the government in Beijing. Rumors spread that government-issued iodized salt had contraceptives in it as a way to wipe out the community. DeLong and his Chinese medical colleagues approached local officials with a different idea. They would put iodine in the irrigation canals. Crops would absorb it in their water, and people in the Taklamakan region would eat it in their food. The officials agreed to the plan, and when DeLong later gave children from the region IQ tests, their average score jumped 16 points. Chemically altering people's brains isn't the only way to change their scores on intelligence tests. James Flynn, a social scientist at the University of Otago in New Zealand, has discovered that across the world, IQ test scores have been steadily increasing. Flynn's first inkling of this shift came in 1984. He had asked a Dutch colleague to send him results of IQ tests administered to 18-year-olds in the Netherlands. When the scores arrived in the mail, he settled down to peruse them. A puzzling discrepancy jumped out. Dutch students in the 1980s did substantially better than students in the 1950s. Flynn found a similar trend in nearly 30 developed countries. In Britain and the United States, for example, test scores increased 0.3 points a year. If the average score in 2000 was 100, then it would have been 70 in 1900. We are driven to the absurd conclusion that a majority of our ancestors were mentally retarded, Flynn wrote in his 2007 book, What is Intelligence? Yet this trend, now known as the Flynn effect, has been confirmed many times over. As we've gotten taller, we've gotten smarter. Now the challenge is to figure out what's driving this increase. As in the case of height, the Flynn effect has been too big and quick to pin on genetic change. For that to be the case, people who scored high on intelligence tests would have to have much bigger families than everyone else to spread their genes, and that hasn't happened. It's possible that what's been happening to intelligence test scores is similar to what's been happening to height. The global height boom has been brought about in part by better food, sanitation, medicine, and, in some places, greater economic equality. Some of the same factors may be at play in the Flynn effect. Better childhood health and nutrition makes the body grow quickly and the brain develop well. Government regulations have also helped. Farrer has argued that the push to give people iodine played a part in the worldwide Flynn effect. Exposure to lead can be toxic for the brain, and up until the 1970s, American children were exposed to high levels of lead in paint and gasoline. In 2014, Alan Kaufman, an intelligence expert at Yale, and his colleagues published a study on intelligence tests they gave to hundreds of Americans who were exposed to high lead levels before the 1970s and to hundreds more Americans who were born afterward. They estimated that lowering lead levels in children gave them a boost of 4 to 5 IQ points. But scientists are also investigating other possible causes, because they're keenly aware that intelligence isn't just affected by molecules that flow through the brain. Our behaviors are shaped by our experiences, particularly the ones we have with other people. As our parents talk to us, they help build our vocabularies, for example. The world's fertility rate dropped drastically over the past century. In 1950, it was 5 children per woman. In 2010, it was 2.5. In a smaller family, the children have the opportunity to listen more to their parents. Going to school can also raise intelligence test scores. To measure schooling's effect, 2 statisticians, Christian Brinch and Taryn Ann Galloway, took advantage of reforms that Norway put into place starting in the 1950s. By reorganizing their school system, the Norwegians increased the time students had to spend in school from 7 years to 9. Different towns made the switch at different times between 1955 and 1972. Brinch and Galloway looked at how the extra schooling affected the IQ tests that 19-year-old men took as part of Norway's universal draft. In 2012, they reported an extra year of education raised scores by 3.7 IQ points. This natural experiment takes on greater importance when you consider how much more schooling children get now than in previous centuries. In the United States, the enrollment rate in the early 1900s was 50%. By 1960, it reached 90%. American students went from an average schooling of 6.5 years to 12. To Flynn himself, the Flynn effect doesn't mean that people in the 19th century were intellectually disabled, nor does it mean that people today have neurons that fire signals to each other in a fundamentally new way. Our forerunners relied on ways of thinking suited to their age. In the early 1900s, intelligence tests included questions like, "What do dogs and rabbits have in common?" The answer that the test givers wanted was that they were both mammals, but often the answer they got instead was, "You use dogs to hunt rabbits." To people who spent their time hunting rather than learning taxonomy, that fact was the one that mattered. 20th century schooling began to train students more in thinking in terms of classification, logic, and hypotheses. To get a job, people had to understand how to operate machines, and then computers. Rather than hunting rabbits with dogs, children today are more likely to pass their free time on a smartphone. Flynn's argument is also bolstered by the way the Flynn effect spread over the world. It started in the United States and Europe, but as developing countries became more modernized, their intelligence test scores started their own upward trend. As in the case of height, intelligence forces us to hold 2 contradictory ideas in our heads at once. Over the past century, the world has gotten taller and smarter. But these increases were not brought about by a shift in our genetic variants. The change is so dramatic that it can be hard to see how genes matter at all. And yet heredity has not stopped mattering. Height was a strongly heritable trait in the early 1900s, when scientists first began to measure it. Intelligence was as well. Today, both remain heritable. Under similar conditions, people will grow to different heights and get different scores on intelligence tests, in part because of the genes they inherited. It's also becoming clear that we can't treat genes and the environment as 2 distinct forces that act independently of each other. Each one influences the other. In 2003, Eric Turkheimer of the University of Virginia and his colleagues gave a twist to the standard studies on twins. To calculate the heritability of intelligence, they decided not to just look at the typical middle-class families who were the subject of earlier studies. They looked for twins from poorer families, too. Turkheimer and his colleagues found that the socioeconomic class determined how heritable intelligence was. Among children who grew up in affluent families, the heritability was about 60%, but twins from poorer families showed no greater correlation than other siblings. Their heritability was close to zero. It may seem weird that the environment itself can change heritability. We tend to think of genes as rigid purveyors of destiny, the inescapable agents of heredity. But biologists have always known that the two are intimately linked together. If you raise corn in uniformly healthy soil, with the same level of abundant sunlight and water, the variation in their height will largely be the product of the variation in their genes. But if you plant them in a bad soil, where they may or may not get enough of some vital nutrient, the environment will be responsible for more of their differences. Turkheimer's study hints that something similar happens to intelligence. By focusing their research on affluent families or on countries such as Norway, where people get universal health care, intelligence researchers may end up giving too much credit to heredity. Poverty may be powerful enough to swamp the influence of variants in our DNA. In the years since Turkheimer's study, some researchers have gotten the same results, although others have not. It's possible that the effect is milder than once thought. A 2016 study pointed to another possibility, however. It showed that poverty reduced the heritability of intelligence in the United States, but not in Europe. Perhaps Europe just doesn't impoverish the soil of its children enough to see the effect. Yet there's another paradox in the relationship between genes and the environment. Over time, genes can mold the environment in which our intelligence develops. In 2010, Robert Plomin led a study on 11,000 twins from four countries, measuring their heritability at different ages. At age 9, the heritability of intelligence was 42%. By age 12, it had risen to 54%, and at age 17, it was at 68%. In other words, the genetic variants we inherit assert themselves more strongly as we get older. Plomin has argued that this shift happens as people with different variants end up in different environments. A child who has trouble reading due to inherited variants may shy away from books and not get the benefits that come from reading them. A child who learns quickly how to do math may get encouraged by teachers to do more. As children get older, they gain more power to choose those environments, which can shape their intelligence even more. We think of the environment as our physical surroundings, of heat and cold, of chemicals and food. But as humans, we also build an environment around ourselves of words and numbers. When Galton and Pearson investigated the inheritance of height, they presented their results in cool prose, letting the statistics speak for themselves. When they turned their attention to intelligence, however, their lectures and papers became sermons. Galton promised a galaxy of genius through eugenics. Pearson, writing in 1904, drew a darker conclusion. For the last 40 years, he warned, the intellectual classes of the nation, enervated by wealth or by love of pleasure, or following an erroneous standard of life, have ceased to give us in due proportion the men we want to carry on the ever-growing work of our empire. American eugenicists saw the same moral contrast between height and intelligence. They didn't see any need to promote the height of the nation, but to protect American intelligence from feeble-mindedness, they were ready to sterilize, to institutionalize, to bar immigrants. Nazis made much of intelligence as well, their hereditary courts making their decisions based on test scores. Yet those scores had to fit into Nazism's racist ideology, not vice versa. When German psychiatrists called for the sterilization of even the mildly feeble-minded, their proposal was shot down. Many of Hitler's young brown shirts would have fallen into that category, not to mention 10% of the German army. Friedrich Bartels, the deputy leader of the Reich doctors, rejected intelligence tests because they could condemn decent young German peasants. He said it was wrong to judge the value of a Nazi party member based on how much trivia they knew, such as the year Columbus was born. Such a man might very well have spent his life until then working in the fields rather than taking classes. It is quite possible that he has never had the chance to learn these things, Bartels complained. As early as the 1920s, some psychologists were challenging the fatalism of people like Galton and Pearson. Helen Barrett and Helen Koch of the University of Chicago studied a group of children who were moved from an orphanage into preschool, where they were no longer neglected. After 6 months, Barrett and Koch claimed, their test scores jumped far beyond those of the children left behind in the orphanage. Intelligence was not simply the result of heredity, they argued, but also the quality of homes and schools. In the 1930s, psychologists in Iowa ran a bigger study that came to a similar conclusion. In 1938, one of the researchers, George Stoddard, went to a conference in New York to describe the results, and a reporter from Time delivered the astonishing news. One of the few fixed stars in the creed of orthodox psychologists is a belief that people are born with a certain degree of intelligence and are doomed to go through life with the same IQ, the Time reporter explained. But Stoddard, moon-faced, enthusiastic, proved that an individual's IQ can be changed. Stoddard and his team tracked 275 children who were put into foster care. Their parents were poor, badly educated, and scored below average on intelligence tests. After being placed in better-than-average homes, Time reported, they scored an average IQ of 116, equal to the average for children of university professors. The Iowa studies led Stoddard to reject the eugenicist claim that heredity trumped all. Dull parents are as likely to produce potentially bright children as are clever parents, Stoddard declared. The way to improve a child's intelligence is to give him security, encourage him in habits of experiencing, inquiring, relating, symbolizing. Hereditarians attacked Stoddard's work, pointing out its many statistical weaknesses. His critics maintained that intelligence tests measured something fixed in people, and Stoddard's calls for a national network of preschools went ignored. When World War II came, it focused the country's attention abroad, and the prosperity of the 1950s left many Americans unaware of the poverty that others endured in the country. After World War II, most Americans no longer followed Lewis Terman's example, claiming that Southern and Eastern Europeans inherited low intelligence. But some still maintained that heredity was to blame for the gap between whites and blacks. Henry Garrett, the prominent psychologist who kept the Kallikaks alive in his textbooks, claimed that blacks were as intelligent on average as a white person after a lobotomy. Garrett was an ardent supporter of segregation, and he brought his considerable credentials, former president of the American Psychological Association and professor at Columbia University, to the fight against racial equality. He served as a star witness for the segregationist defense in Brown v. Board of Education and acted as an FBI informant, reporting on the communistic theories his fellow Columbia University professors were spreading about the equality of the races. In 1955, Garrett retired from Columbia and moved back to the South to fight full-time. He testified to Congress in 1967 against a civil rights bill, lecturing the politicians about the evolutionary immaturity of the Negro. He became a director of the Pioneer Fund, a eugenics organization founded in 1937 to promote the conservation of the best racial stocks. Garrett also became a prolific pamphleteer. Pro-segregation groups distributed over 500,000 of his pamphlets to American public school teachers, free of charge. Today, neo-Nazi groups continue to sell them. In his pamphlets, Garrett railed against mixing blacks and whites, both in schools and in marriages. Such a disaster would drag down Western civilization, he warned, pointing to studies that showed a 15-to-20-point gap between American whites and blacks on IQ tests. Garrett claimed that the differences were fixed by heredity. The notion that blacks and whites were equal was, Garrett declared, the scientific hoax of the century. He pinned the blame for the hoax, unsurprisingly, on the Jews. Garrett faced stiff opposition from many of his fellow American psychologists. They argued that poverty had a tremendous power over young minds. Experiments on animals were revealing just how crucial experiences could be to the early development of the brain. If kittens had their eyes sewn shut for just a few crucial days, they were left blind for the rest of their lives. A growing number of psychologists argued that children had a crucial window in their own development. If their early years were deprived, their intelligence would suffer just as their growth would be stunted. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson launched the preschool network that the Iowa psychologists had called for three decades earlier. The Head Start program began enrolling hundreds of thousands of poor children. Robert E. Cook, a Johns Hopkins pediatrician and the chair of Head Start's original planning committee, would later describe the program as a rejection of heredity's power. The fundamental theoretical basis of Head Start was the concept that intellect is, to a large extent, a product of experience, not inheritance, he said. In later years, social scientists would document many benefits to the Head Start program. It raised the graduation rate of children by more than 5%, for instance. Among children with mothers who didn't finish high school, the rate rose by more than 10%. But it did not help children's intelligence test scores in the long run. At 3 and 4 years of age, their scores improved, only to drift back down by first grade. Critics jumped on these findings as evidence that blacks scored lower than whites on intelligence tests due to their genes. In a 1967 lecture, an educational psychologist named Arthur Jensen declared that the lower average scores that blacks got on intelligence tests do indeed reflect innate, genetically determined aspects of intellectual ability. In the decades since, others have made similar claims from time to time. For the most part, though, psychologists and geneticists alike have rejected them. It's clear that intelligence test scores are heritable, but just because two groups differ in a heritable trait does not mean that the difference between them is genetic. The study of height provides a clear and uncontroversial demonstration of this rule. South Koreans are more than an inch taller on average than North Koreans. Height is even more heritable than intelligence. But these two facts don't add up to the conclusion that South Koreans have height-boosting alleles that are missing from North Koreans. In fact, we can be pretty confident they don't. Koreans only became two groups in the 1950s. Only afterward, as South Korea prospered and North Korea fell into the twilight of dictatorship, did their heights diverge. Nor does the failure of Head Start serve as proof that the 1960s gap in intelligence test scores was some unalterable fact of heredity. The Flynn effect did not leave behind American blacks, for example. In fact, their intelligence test scores have risen dramatically, while American whites had a more modest improvement. The gap between the two groups narrowed by more than 40% between 1980 and 2012, according to one estimate. Studies like these have led some critics to argue that research on the hereditary basis of intelligence is irrelevant at best and toxic at worst. If our goal is to improve the intellect of children, then we have plenty of obvious but hard work to do. We should fix the fumbling bureaucracies that run schools, stop programs that don't work, put ones into effect that do, and fix the causes of inequalities in education. We can also look beyond schools to take on the harmful stress of poverty or the continuing threat of lead in drinking water. Such efforts need no genetic information or even IQ testing and are likely to be hindered by the hereditary concept of intelligence, writes Dorothy Roberts, a University of Pennsylvania law professor. Geneticists have fought back, calling these attacks caricatures of the modern study of intelligence. They are not using weak science to justify the status quo or to argue for the superiority of one race over another, nor are they claiming that because a trait is heritable means that interventions are pointless. Some point to the case of eyesight as an analogy. Eyesight is a strongly heritable trait, and yet eyeglasses can overcome the bad vision that children inherit from their parents. It would be absurd to say that there's no point trying to improve bad eyesight, since it's heritable. In fact, some geneticists argue, understanding how heredity influences intelligence may potentially lead to policies that do a better job of helping children flourish. When education researchers test out new programs, they compare how well students do with it or without. In order for those studies to yield reliable results, the researchers have to make sure the two groups are random samples of students. If one group just so happens to have a lot of the variants known to influence intelligence or educational attainment, the study may deceive the researchers. They may come to believe a program is going to have a powerful effect, only to find out too late that it's just a waste of time and money. Some researchers have gone further and predicted that DNA scans will make it possible to tailor school programs to each child. Genetic tests can already reveal some severe forms of intellectual disability in newborns, and, in some cases, that knowledge is power. A child diagnosed today with PKU doesn't have to face Carol Buck's fate. By inspecting thousands of intelligence-related spots in the DNA of children, it might be possible to make predictions about how they will fare in school. Some variants might turn out to influence G, influencing overall intelligence, while others might affect only certain mental abilities. Catherine Asbury, a lecturer at the University of York, has argued that these genetic tests might allow parents to intervene early with children who are, for example, dyslexic. If a simple blood test at birth could spot children with a probable risk of struggling in any of these areas, she says, then imagine the tailored interventions that might nip such risk in the bud, or at least reduce its effects. Precision education, as this approach has been called, has a sleek, futuristic appeal. But for now, and probably for decades, it's only a placeholder of an idea. In the meantime, less sexy tasks will help children more, such as getting the lead out of drinking water in schools and getting enough textbooks for students. Instead of providing concrete help, research on heredity may end up fueling fallacies about the nature of intelligence. Unfortunately, psychologists have found, our minds have vulnerabilities when it comes to such matters. There's a reason that the Kallikak family, with its simplistic, destructive vision of heredity in society, sold as well as it did. In 2011, the psychologists Ilan Dar Nimrod and Stephen Heine dubbed this kind of thinking genetic essentialism. Dar Nimrod and Heine argued that genetic essentialism arises from how we make sense of the world. Decades of psychological research have shown that our minds instinctively sort things into categories. We ascribe the same essence to everything in the same category. Birds all have birdiness, and fish have fishiness. When psychologists try to get people to describe these essences, words often fail them. Feathers are a manifestation of birdiness, but if a bird gets sick and loses its feathers, we still consider it a bird. We use essentialism to make sense not just of birds, but of each other as well. Early in childhood, we learn to view people as having essential characteristics, which we perceive as being present at birth and enduring throughout life. Our built-in essentialism made it easy for us to misunderstand heredity. Genes seem like they belong to our essence. We inherit them from our parents and carry them till we die. It's tempting to conclude that nothing we do in our lives can change what our genes bring about. We are successful because we have genes for success. Races are different because the people in each race share genes not found in any other race. Genetic essentialism turns out to be stronger in some people than in others. In one study, psychologists measured people's racism by asking them questions such as whether they'd approve of their child marrying a black partner or whether they think blacks have only themselves to blame for not doing well. It turns out that people who ascribe more of the differences between races to genes score higher on tests of racism. It's even possible to manipulate people's genetic essentialism. In 2014, Dar Nimrod and his colleagues had 162 college students fill out questionnaires about the foods they liked and their eating habits. Then they all read what looked like a newspaper article, which in fact had been written by the scientists. Some students read an article explaining that obesity is caused by bad genes. Others read an article explaining how people get obese if they're surrounded by friends who eat too much. Another group read an article about food with no mention of obesity. Finally, all the students were led to another room, where there was a big bowl of chocolate chip cookies that were broken into pieces. The scientists explained they were going to use cookies in another experiment, but they wanted to make sure they tasted right. They asked the students to eat some cookies and give their opinion. In fact, the cookies were part of the experiment, too. After the students left, the scientists measured how much they had eaten. The students who had read the genetic article ate almost 52 grams of cookies. The ones who read the article on social networks ate only 33 grams, and the ones who read the article that didn't mention obesity ate 37 grams. The concept of genes driving people's appetite caused them to lose some control of their own. In a society that practically worships DNA, we are running this experiment on a colossal scale. Part 3. The Pedigree Within. Chapter 11. Ex Ovo Omnia. Divide your mind's eye like a split screen. On the left, picture a single bacterium. On the right, a fertilized human egg. The bacterium grows, duplicates its DNA, and splits itself in 2, then 4, then 8. The 8 bacteria are kin, joined to the original microbe by the bonds of heredity. They inherited copies of its chromosome. Each new generation of bacteria is made of the proteins, RNA molecules, and other ingredients of their mother cell. You could trace their heredity over time by drawing a branching family tree. The fertilized egg does much the same thing. It grows, copies its DNA, and splits in 2, then 4, then 8. The human cells may be hundreds of times bigger than the bacteria, and they may divide at a far slower pace. But in a developing embryo, cells share a heredity as well. Each pair of new daughter cells inherits copies of their mother's cell's DNA, along with half of its other molecules. It may seem strange to use the language of heredity for what happens in our own bodies. We tend to think of heredity only as a way to link ourselves biologically to the past and to the future. Yet heredity does not stop when a new life begins. Each of the 37 trillion cells in our bodies resides on a branch of a genealogical tree that runs all the way back to our origin at conception. Before long, the split screen diverges. As the bacteria divide, they grow into a jumbled colony of identical cells. The egg's descendants, on the other hand, develop into a human form, complete with a head and face, with fingers and toes. And along the way, the cells that make up the new embryo give rise to different kinds of cells. Now its inner heredity shifts to a new style. Each cell in the stomach lining gives rise to two cells of the stomach lining. Now bone cells divide reliably to make more bone rather than pads of fat. Textbooks say that the human body has about 200 cell types, but recent studies have rendered that figure a laughable understatement. No one can say how many cell types there are, because the more scientists examine cells, the more they break down into more types. Immune cells may all carry out the same mission to save us from pathogens and cancer, but they are an army with hundreds of divisions. All our cell types are separate branches on the body's genealogical tree, like rival dynasties descended from a first monarch. This transformation poses the chief question that developmental biologists have asked for centuries and continue to ask. How does a cell with a single set of genes give rise to the complexity of the human body? Heredity supplies the answer, but it does so in different forms. Heredity, in other words, is more than one thing. Aristotle asked himself this question, but he could try to answer it only by cracking open chicken eggs. If he opened an egg the day it was laid by a hen, he saw only the white and the yolk. He observed nothing more on the second day or the third. But on the fourth day, he could make out a red speck. This he took for the heart. This point beats and moves as though endowed with life, Aristotle said. Over the next few days, other things became visible in the egg. Tubes filled with blood sent out branches. The dim mass of a body emerged. Aristotle could eventually make out a head, adorned with a pair of bulging eyes. A chicken embryo at this stage looked a lot like the embryos of other animals Aristotle had studied. But as the days passed, the similarity faded, overtaken by the peculiar features of birds: a beak, feathers, claws, wings. About the 20th day, if you open the egg and touch the chick, it moves inside and chirps, Aristotle observed. Some philosophers of Aristotle's age believed that the parts of a chicken, or any other animal, somehow existed in miniature even before this development. Aristotle would have nothing of it. He saw the development of an embryo as akin to making cheese. A cheesemaker added fig juice to milk, setting about a transformation that created something that did not exist beforehand. When chickens mated, the rooster's semen triggered a similar transformation of fluids inside the hen. Organs curdled into existence in an unfolding sequence. The spirit within the semen shaped a heart, which in turn shaped other organs, which in turn shaped more of the chick's body, until it was complete. For 2,000 years, Western scholars and physicians hewed closely to Aristotle's vision, but the scientific revolution brought a realization that he had gotten some things wrong. William Harvey, the royal physician to King James I and Charles I of England, searched for Aristotle's curdling fluids inside does and hens. He could find none. Like Aristotle, Harvey inspected embryos of chickens. The heart did not form first, he realized. Blood vessels took shape earlier. To account for these differences, Harvey came up with a different vision of life's beginning. It was from eggs that all animals grew. When he published a book about his idea in 1651, he emblazoned it with the Latin motto, Ex ovo omnia. You can search Harvey's book from cover to cover and still be left baffled by what he meant by ovo. While Harvey was sure that mammals had eggs, he could never find any evidence of them. Instead, he speculated that the hypothetical eggs were produced by the female body much as the mind produces thoughts. Semen then acted on the eggs so that they began to develop into embryos. In this regard, Harvey still remained faithful to his hero Aristotle. The different parts of the body all emerged from a homogeneous beginning. He called this unfolding epigenesis. Other scholars in the 17th century began promoting a radically different theory for how new generations emerged. Known as preformationists, they argued that all the anatomy of an animal already existed before conception. In the 1670s, a Dutch naturalist named Nicolaus Hartsuyker discovered sperm, using newly invented microscopes. He drew the head of a sperm with a tiny human lodged inside. Preformationism held sway until the mid-1700s, when new observations exposed its flaws. A German medical student named Caspar Friedrich Wolff studied chicken embryos more carefully than anyone ever before and could find no trace of a miniature bird in their earliest stages. Instead, he saw a blob of unorganized tissue that gradually took on new structures, which only later turned into recognizable parts of a chicken's body. The 1800s brought more powerful microscopes, which scientists used to make new discoveries about development. Only then, for example, did they finally discover the mammal eggs that Harvey had dreamed up 2 centuries earlier, first in a dog and then in a woman. After fertilization with sperm, eggs could then develop. It also became clearer what the eggs were developing into. Under the new microscopes, animal bodies resolved into tiny units. These units looked different depending on what tissue they came from: the blobs in blood, the long fibers in muscles, the brickwork of skin. But researchers realized they were all variations on a theme. There is one universal principle of development for the elementary parts of organisms, the German zoologist Theodor Schwann declared in 1839, and this principle is in the formation of cells. The new cell theory raised new questions of its own, such as how cells came to be. Some naturalists argue that cells spontaneously formed out of biological fluids, the way hard-edged crystals could form out of a featureless soup of chemicals. But a group of German biologists proved that new cells emerged only from old ones. It was a microscopic form of like engendering like. The biologist Rudolf Virchow decided it was time to update Harvey's motto. Ex ovo omnia became omnis cellula e cellula. Every cell comes from a cell, inheriting its traits from its ancestor. Cells, it became clear, were not unique to animals. Plants were made of cells, as were fungi. Bacteria and protozoans had bodies made up of a single cell. Different forms of life made new cells in different ways. Bacteria, for example, simply divided in two. A species like the yeast used a somewhat different cycle. A mother cell might split in two, but the two daughter cells would remain firmly stuck together. As the division continued, the yeast grew into a mat, not exactly a body like ours, but not a group of isolated organisms either. Animals and plants, on the other hand, developed into giant collectives of cells, which reproduced by making new collectives. To reproduce, some aquatic animals, such as corals and sponges, simply break off a packet of cells known as a bud. The bud drifts away, settles on a new spot on the seafloor, and grows into its own full-size body. When animals reproduce by budding, it's hard to draw a clean dividing line between ancestors and descendants. They all belong to the same unbroken line of cell divisions. Even though the new animals have distinct bodies, you can still think of them as overgrowths of their ancestors. Most animals, humans included, can't reproduce by budding. Cut off your arm and it will not grow into a second you. We and most other animal species develop from a single fertilized egg, called a zygote. Like other cells, zygotes don't leap into existence out of the void. Each is the fusion of two older cells. The continuity of zygotes with the previous generation led some scientists to propose that children are the overgrowth of their two parents. Overgrowth sounds like a chaotic, weedy explosion of life, but the development of animal embryos is nothing of the sort. Most animal embryos change from a nondescript ball into a shell, with a clump of cells stuck to its interior wall. The cells making up the shell become the placenta, while the clump becomes the embryo itself. The clump spreads out into a sheet made up of three layers. Those layers came to be known as the ectoderm, the endoderm, and the mesoderm. You started out from these three layers, and so did a grasshopper, and so did a tapeworm. Those layers go on to form different tissues of the body. When biologists began to look at later stages of developing embryos, they could start making out newly formed tissues. Each type was made up of its own distinctive set of cells. Yet no matter how distinctive they became on the outside, they still remained similar within. A sprawling neuron and a sheet-shaped epithelial cell both had a nucleus at their core, inside of which they held identical chromosomes. To August Weismann, the man who cut off mouse tails to champion Darwin over Lamarck, this unfolding variety was hard to fathom. How is it, he asked, that such a single cell can reproduce the tout ensemble, the total impression of the parent with all the faithfulness of a portrait? Weismann's many years of looking at animal embryos led him to an answer. When a fertilized egg divided, it bequeathed its nucleus to its offspring, and inside that nucleus was a mysterious thing Weismann called hereditary tendencies. Those descendant cells passed down the same tendencies when they divided. Weismann reasoned that the only way that cells in an embryo could take on different identities would be to inherit different hereditary tendencies. When a cell divided, in other words, it had to determine which of its daughters inherited which tendencies. Early on in development, a cell might bequeath the tendency to become ectoderm to one cell, and the tendency to become mesoderm to the other. Each cell could then pass down only its specific tendency to its daughter cells. Later on, an ectodermal cell might divide its hereditary tendencies unequally once more. Some of its descendants might inherit only the tendencies for becoming a skin cell, others a nerve. For Weismann, in other words, the development of an embryo was a saga of loss. By the time organs like stomachs and thyroid glands emerged, their cells lacked most of the original hereditary tendencies in the fertilized egg. They could only divide into more stomach cells or thyroid cells. They could never produce a new animal, tout ensemble. Thinking about development this way, Weismann turns his attention to how embryos produce their own supply of new eggs or sperm. He had observed this process for himself, and he had been struck by how early they developed, and how they then were set aside while the rest of the embryo continued to grow. Weismann became convinced that this early isolation was vital, because eggs and sperm had to be set aside before they lost too many hereditary tendencies. There must be a profound distinction between sperm and eggs, which Weismann called germ cells, and the rest of the body, which he called somatic cells. Weismann split heredity in two. One form of heredity joined parents to their children. According to Weismann, parents were custodians of the germplasm, a mysterious hereditary substance that could produce an entire human being. Over the generations, the germplasm never lost its ability to give rise to new life. Germplasm heredity gave geneticists the concept they needed to make sense of Mendel's experiments, to observe how hereditary factors could hop down through the generations like rocks skipping across a pond. To geneticists, what happened during development didn't matter much. It was just a dead end made of disposable flesh. But Weismann also recognized another kind of heredity playing out inside of each of us. He illustrated this inner heredity with pictures. In his book, The Germplasm, A Theory of Heredity, Weismann represented a threadworm's development in the form of a tree, an embryonic pedigree, as it were. At the base of the tree, he drew a circle, representing a single fertilized egg. The circle sprouted a pair of branches, to stand for the zygote's division into two daughter cells. One branch led to a white dot, which branched in turn into more white dots. These represented ectodermal cells. The other branch gave rise to other lineages of endoderm, mesoderm, and germ cells. If you didn't know you were looking at a threadworm, you might think you were looking at the Habsburg dynasty's family tree. This tree, Weismann was quick to caution, was just a theoretical illustration. He drew it only to convey his ideas about the crucial division between germ cells and somatic cells. But the picture inspired other biologists to look at the development of real embryos and draw trees of their own. One of the first biologists to draw these cellular genealogies was a young American graduate student named Edwin Grant Conklin. Conklin started his own artwork in the summer of 1890 when he traveled to the seaside village of Woods Hole, Massachusetts, to find something to study for his PhD. He ended up scraping slipper limpets off crab shells and harvesting their eggs. The limpet eggs were so big and transparent that Conklin could observe them clearly under a microscope. He drew the portrait of a limpet egg, down to the nucleus and other structures within. He drew another when the egg divided in two. Each time the embryo divided, he made a new portrait in pencil, identifying each new cell according to its ancestor. His portraits changed from tiny batches of cells into large spheres, and then into more complex shapes. "I followed individual cells through the development, followed them until many people laughed about it," Conklin later recalled. They called it cellular bookkeeping. The hours that Conklin spent staring through his microscope made him an object of mockery in the lab. One day, a fellow graduate student named Ross Harrison came behind me while I was anxiously studying some of the cleavage forms under the microscope and hung a crab on my left ear, Conklin said. That crab pierced the earlobe and could not be taken off except by some of the other sympathetic people in the laboratory. Harrison sprinted away and Conklin bolted in chase. "I ran for half a mile or more without catching him," Conklin said. Despite these distractions, Conklin managed to draw a prodigious number of images. When he got back to Baltimore, he numbered each cell so that readers could follow their multiplication from stage to stage. Conklin wrote a paper about the limpet's transformation, which he gave to his advisor, William Keith Brooks, to read. A few days later, Brooks brought the manuscript back to Conklin. "Well, Conklin," he said loudly, so that the other students in the lab could hear, "this university is sometimes given the doctor's degree for counting words. I think maybe it might give one degree for counting cells." The other students roared with laughter. "I certainly felt pretty small," Conklin said. The next summer, Conklin went back to Woods Hole and collected more limpets. One day, a professor named Edmund Beecher Wilson walked up to his lab table and said he had been doing a similar study on the larvae of leeches. Conklin and Wilson sat down together and compared their drawings. They were shocked to see how similar their embryos were, even from their earliest stages of development. Wilson became Conklin's mentor, introducing him to other scientists and helping him publish his research in scientific journals. Conklin went on to draw painstakingly detailed embryos of other species, tracing the lineages of cells further than anyone had managed before. As Conklin uncovered the lineages, he found a new way to tackle the centuries-old debate about how a single egg developed into a complex body. He could trace the division of cells as they produced tissues and organs. He watched generations of cells gradually part ways, committing to an existence as muscle or nerves or some other tissue. In some cases, the fate of cell lineages was fixed at the start. In other cases, cells seemed to hold on to the capacity to take on a range of different final forms. Conklin turned cell lineages into an essential part of embryology. Later generations of scientists examined these embryonic pedigrees as they sought to understand how the cells reached their final identities, and how their identities became locked for life. Although genetics was booming at the time, embryologists didn't think it could help them solve this mystery. They thought geneticists, who had yet even to show what genes were made of, were supremely arrogant to think they would be the ones to solve Aristotle's mysteries. "The wanderlust of geneticists is beginning to urge them in our direction," Conklin's crab-wielding nemesis Ross Harrison warned an audience of embryologists in 1937. This threatened invasion, as Harrison called it, would lead only to nonsense. There was no way that simplistic explanations based on genes and their mutations could make sense of the majestic unfolding of development. Geneticists could busy themselves with finding mutations that change the color of a fly's eye, Harrison said. He and his fellow embryologists were after bigger game, how the eye itself came to be. Harrison was certainly right that in 1937, geneticists didn't know enough to help explain embryos. But even as Harrison rallied his troops to man the university ramparts, a British embryologist was already thinking about how he could let the enemy in. Conrad Waddington carried out experiments at the University of Cambridge, moving bits of tissue around chick embryos to see if he could disturb their development. But he also had a philosopher's detachment. He could rise above the fine details of ectoderm and endoderm, and think in the abstract about how genes might guide development. Each cell in an embryo, Waddington hypothesized, was a little factory. It used its many genes to produce many proteins, some of which could spread to other cells. Different cells produced different proteins, creating complicated chemical blends that were different from one place to another in the embryo. The particular blend a cell was exposed to could cause it to take on a new identity as it developed. Waddington shared Weissman's fondness for pictures. To illustrate the development of embryos, he drew a hillside shot through with forking valleys. He imagined a lineage of cells as a ball rolling down this landscape. The slope of the surface could guide it down one valley or another, committing to becoming a particular type of cell. Waddington had an artistic friend illustrate this landscape with two pictures, one looking down from above and the other looking up from below. The underside of the landscape was anchored with guy wires, pulling down to create the valleys that drove cells to their final states. Waddington liked to call this strange terrain the epigenetic landscape, borrowing the old language of Harvey and Aristotle. Waddington used the term, as he explained in a 1956 textbook, for the theory that development is brought about through a series of cause interactions between the various parts. Waddington freely admitted that his epigenetic landscape was just an idea, one that was valuable mainly as a way to guide his thoughts. Although the epigenetic landscape only provides a rough-and-ready picture of the developing embryo and cannot be interpreted rigorously, he wrote, it has certain merits for those who, like myself, find it comforting to have some mental picture, however vague, for what they are trying to think about. The pictures that Weissman, Conklin, and Waddington drew were like visions from the future. They captured some of the overall truth of how we develop, but they lacked the specifics. The three biologists made mistakes, albeit forgivable ones. Weissman, it turned out, was wrong to say that hereditary tendencies are divvied up between daughter cells. The DNA that encodes someone's genes is replicated in full each time a cell divides. What makes a sweat gland cell different from a taste bud cell is the combination of genes that are active in each of them, as well as the combination that is silent. And that difference can be passed down from mother cells to daughter cells. It's an inheritance, but not of some particular mutation. It's the inheritance of a state, a configuration of life's network. And the first glimpse of how that network is configured came to a woman whose day job was to prepare for the apocalypse. In the 1950s, hydrogen bombs were lighting up the world in test after test. It seemed as if nuclear war might not be far away. Movies distilled the anxiety and projected it onto theater screens. In Godzilla, a radiation-induced monster tramples Tokyo. The giant ants of Them slaughter people with formic acid. The Day the Earth Caught Fire imagines nuclear bombs pushing Earth out of its orbit around the sun. Nuclear nightmares featured not just incineration, but also a gruesome transformation of heredity. The people who did not evaporate in a blast would be pierced with radiation. It could damage cells deep in their bodies, causing radiation sickness and cancer. If an alpha particle crashed into an egg or sperm cell, it could alter the DNA inside, thereby extending nuclear war's ravages to future generations. The survivors might pass down the mutations to their descendants, along with the diseases they caused. The British government decided it needed a lab to study this sort of damage, and it needed scientists like Mary Lyon to work there. Lyon, a quiet, focused 30-year-old geneticist, was hired in 1955 to work at the Radiobiological Research Unit of the Medical Research Council. It was still rare for a woman to hold such a job. When Lyon had gone to the University of Cambridge to read zoology, she was allowed to receive only a titular degree, even though she worked as hard as her male colleagues. Nevertheless, she made such a strong impression on her advisors that they helped her get a spot as a graduate student with Ronald Fisher, the geneticist who had combined Mendel and Galton's concepts of heredity into a new form in the 1920s. Fisher turned out to be an irascible screamer who regularly threw graduate students out of his lab. But Lyon earned his respect, and he put her in charge of some of the mutant mice he studied. She carried out elegant experiments to see how one mutation could give rise to different traits, such as a splotchy coat and a loss of balance. But she decided Fisher's rage-choked lab was too toxic for her to grow as a scientist. She was a fan of Conrad Waddington's new ideas about epigenetics, and so she went to the University of Edinburgh, where he had become the chairman of the biology department, to finish her PhD. Lyon thrived scientifically in Edinburgh, staying on after finishing her dissertation to continue her research. Waddington provided his scientists with the latest technology, and they discussed the newest ideas about heredity and development. Though pensive and humble, Lyon nevertheless gained a reputation in Edinburgh for seeing right through scientific problems. She would politely challenge her male elders if she found their reasoning flawed. The friends Lyon made in Edinburgh grew accustomed to her long silences as she composed what she wanted to say next. Although she thrived as a scientist, her parents still couldn't understand why a woman would waste her time fussing over some odd mice. "They wanted me to get married at one point," she later recalled in an interview. "What did you think about that idea?" her interviewer asked. "I didn't like it." The differences between the sexes came to dominate Lyon's own work. In Edinburgh, Lyon got the chance to study the first mice ever isolated with mutations on the X chromosome. She used them to explore how traits on the X and Y sex chromosomes were passed down. Lyon took her mice with her when the British government transferred her and other Edinburgh biologists to the Radiobiological Research Unit near Oxford. There, they were expected to uncover the genetic risks of nuclear warfare. After 5 years of intellectual ferment in Edinburgh, Lyon found the government bureaucracy in the unit stultifying. As much as she could, she always tried to stick to the mouse work, she said. One strain of mice she studied, called mottled, had a particularly intriguing form of heredity. The female mottled mice developed an assortment of colored patches randomly scattered across their coat. The male mice met one of two very different fates. Either they ended up with a uniform coat, or they died before birth. These clues suggested to Lyon that a deadly mutation lurked on the X chromosomes of mottled mice. Males died if they inherited it because they carried only a single X. Females, with two X's, had better odds of surviving. If one of their X chromosomes lacked the mutation, they would develop normally. Lyon suspected that the mutation was also responsible for the coat patterns of mottled mice. One normal copy of the X chromosome in males produced hairs with identical colors. Somehow, carrying two copies of X chromosomes gave females a mottled coat. Not only that, but the mottling developed into different patterns from one female mouse to the next. Poring through earlier studies on the X chromosome, Lyon searched for evidence that could account for all these strange outcomes. She was led from the narrow question of mottled mice to a much deeper question about X and Y chromosomes. With two copies of an X chromosome, a female ought to make twice as many proteins from their genes than a male. All those extra proteins ought to throw a female's biology into